a lot of times is just making changes on the fly, little adjustments, things that might make a difference further down the line.
That Triathlon Show, episode 26. Welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I bring you an interview with one of the very top elite coaches in triathlon today, Paulo Sousa. Paulo is originally from Lisbon, Portugal, but he resides in Poway, California, and has been living in the US for quite a few years already. In California, in Poway, he has the Triathlon Squad, which is a high-performance coaching environment for elite triathletes that he founded a few years ago, and it's become very successful. And he has, among other athletes in that environment, he has two of three U.S. male Olympians from the Rio 2016 triathlon team. So we'll get into the interview right away, keep the intro short and sweet. Just one more thing to lure you in. Paulo was the USAT Coach of the Year 2016. So if there's anybody you can learn something from, it's definitely from him. So, all right, enjoy this interview with Paulo Sousa. All right, so we've got Paulo Sousa on That Triathlon Show today. Welcome to the show, Paulo.
Oh, thank you.
Are you back from Yokohama yet, or are you still on the roads? Because you've been there for the WTS World Triathlon Series race this past weekend by the time that we record this interview.
Yeah, I was in Yokohama for the WTS. I had some athletes racing there, and now I'm back in the US.
Yeah, okay, perfect. And the reason that you are there, of course, you have athletes racing, and you are the coach of the triathlon squad that operates in California, in Poway. Is that how you pronounce Poway? I'm not quite sure about that.
Okay. Yeah, it's Poway.
Yeah. So the triathlon squad, you have, if I'm correctly informed, you have 9 professional athletes. Is that still current information?
Maybe a little more than that. I it's hard for me to keep track of like the exact number, but yeah, maybe around 12 right now, 12 or 13. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And are most of them still from the United States and Canada and some international, or is it getting more and more international, or what's the breakdown?
Yeah, it's getting more international. For some years, it was mostly US and Canada, but for this season, I got 3 athletes, one from Japan, another from Belgium, and another from Denmark. So like, rough an international flavor now for sure.
Okay, that's really cool. And some of the more well-known athletes that you have are Greg Billington and Joe Malloy, who were US Olympians in Rio this past summer, mm-hmm. and then Summer Cook as well. And the Wurtels are triathletes that the audience will be familiar with. So it's definitely a high-performance squad. What made you decide to form a high-performance environment like that where you operate together on a day-to-day basis?
My involvement with coaching was always on the side of, you know, being interested in performance, and in my previous professional life, I was doing scientific research in fluid dynamics, and then at one point at the end of 2010, it just got to the point where the coaching side of my life was getting really, really big, and I opted to just take the plunge and just go full time and coach full time, and that's when I decided to create the squad basically from scratch, and I just started a project and got a few athletes motivated and involved, and I just took it from there.
So were you already coaching very high level athletes at that point, but you were coaching them remotely?
Yeah, so for the 2009-2010 season, I was involved with coaching some members of the Canadian national team, Simon Whitfield, Kyle Jones, and then at the end of the 2010 season, upon leaving that project, or like it was presented to me at the time, after my contract was not renewed, I decided to just create the squad and embrace coaching full time.
Yeah, and I read an interview on the Sloth, which I think it was, that you also had some frustrations with remote coaching and not being able to really coach the athletes the way that you'd like and that is required on a really high performance level with elite athletes. And that was that also a deciding factor in actually trying to get
for sure. Yes, for sure. For sure. I felt that, and particularly during that year of 2009, 2010, I felt that particularly to work with ITU athletes, the need to be with the athletes and the squad on a daily basis was pretty big, and definitely the limitations of working online were pretty big, and just for me, like, always coaching has been being with the athletes on a daily basis or close to daily basis. The beginnings when I started coaching back in Portugal, it was always with the training with the athletes or coaching the athletes on a daily basis and being with them for a lot of the sessions. So when I decided to go coaching full time and create the squad, was more with that, just like getting back to those beginnings of, you know, coaching the athletes where they are and on a daily basis and just doing that kind of daily work.
So can you name a few of the most important things that you get that you can do when you're coaching an athlete from on the deck or in the field that you just can't if you're not there with them when they're training?
It's basically, you know, the day-to-day operation of the squad is we operate with, I have for each athlete a template that I might follow for a few weeks. And that template is not set in stone. So basically no session is set in stone. And that allows you to just have first off, an attitude where you just operate on the now and what's in front of you, and second, you can just make small adjustments to the sessions, and so you can get a lot more from the schedule than just being tied down to just having a set schedule for the week. So a lot more flexibility. Sometimes it's a lot easier to just, you know, either be at a session and realize that an athlete is having a really good day, and then you can extend the session or just push it a little further. But also a lot of times it's just making changes on the fly, little adjustments, things that might make a difference further down the line.
Yeah, okay. And one thing that I found interesting was that, or that I'm curious about, is that how do you balance the training each athlete individually, but also benefiting from that squad environment and having training sessions where the athletes train with each other, and how does that work?
Yeah, so that's basically one of the things that the integration between the individual and the group, it would be very hard to do without a coach on deck or being there on a daily basis, and most of the times it's going to be about where training with the group or doing the group session is going to favor an individual athlete or where it's not going to favor an individual athlete. So looking for individualization is more on, let's say, like the number of reps that you do from a session or doing a session altogether. I would say that there's going to be differences also between sports. So for example, for the ITU athletes, most of the times, the whole squad is going to do the same swim workout, and maybe small subgroups are going to be doing some different or slightly different bike sessions. And then the run training, I think it's the one where it's more tailored to specific athletes. And a lot of times, I might have, you know, at a session, let's say a track session, I might have like very small groups, like one or two, maybe max three athletes doing one session, and then one or two doing another session, just so that we can really target that that individual aspect of training.
Mm, yeah. And so how many of the sessions or the weekly sessions of an athlete are done either as a part of a larger group or at least with a couple of other athletes of the total? Is it like 80% or is it even closer to 100%, 50%?
It's probably actually like lower than that. I'd say maybe like 60%, something like that. I think it's what's really important is the way we work in our squad is we have a permanent basis in Southern California, where basically from December to April, we're there, you know, basically just training, and this is the off season. So there's not a lot of races, not a lot of athletes going to races at that time. And with that in mind, we need to create an environment that's sustainable for several months. So instead of, for example, there's a lot of squads that have like one training camp for a month and then they just go home for another month. And those training camps can be more intensive. In the case of my squad, I try to have an environment that's sustainable for several months in a row. And for that to work, that it helps to give the athletes a lot of space. And in order for them to have a lot of space, I end up having a lot of sessions that are going to be on your own, meaning that the athletes can do them alone, or they can just, you know, call each other and just hook up for one session or the other. So that, you know, it would be very stressful for the athletes for months at an end, three times a day. They just have to have, you know, their coach and the rest of the squad in their face. That can become a little too intense, a little too stressful. And I even have athletes that have days that they don't even like see the squad, you know, so, or me, for example. So basically they have personal days where they just spend some time where they're training, days that are they're training and they don't have to interact with the squad or me. And I think that all those measures contribute for the sustainability of the program.
Yeah, no, I can totally imagine that. That being said, on the flip side, do you do like other team building things? Like do you eat together from time to time or do other things like that to build a positive group environment?
In our squad, I mostly leave that to the athletes. Like I said, like they're getting like FaceTime with me. It's because we're like working. So I kind of like, I don't like as much to have like activities where just like, oh, today we're going to all go out for dinner. Today we have to do this together. So I kind of like try to stay away from that kind of like team building kind of activities. And I leave it more to the athlete to just, you know, a bunch of times they just get organized to go for dinner or do whatever they want to do. So basically like what I'm thinking here is just, it's just about sustainability of the work. And they already get a lot of FaceTime with me and with each other. So striking a balance between alone time and squad time, I think it's really important.
Yeah. How does this squad environment and how it works and how you operate differ for the long course athletes that you coach? Because I can imagine that it would be much more variable for them because they have different goal races, so are at slightly different points in their periodization, and some may be doing half distance or 70.3 races, and others may be doing full distance races as their goal races. So is there a large variability there in how you operate?
I would say that there's not a lot of variability in training content and structures for 70.3 athletes. For Ironman athletes, probably if you're like preparing an Ironman, then things are going to be very different between ITU programs and Ironman programs. I feel that a lot of times long distance athletes also have a different mental makeup and the way they face and they do their training. Long distance athletes are most of the times more comfortable with doing long sessions on their own or even sessions on their own. While ITU athletes, some because they come from like a team environment, for example, if I have collegiate runners, they are used to a team environment. If I have collegiate swimmers or former collegiate swimmers, they are used to that team environment. So they're more comfortable on with a group environment. So I'd say that like the differences are also going to be to integrate the work between long distance athletes and ITU athletes is more going to have to do a little bit with the way they face training. So for example, this winter, the long distance athletes that I had with the ITU squad, I just had like two of them, the rest, you know, like 10 or 12 were ITU athletes, and ends up being that, you know, the swims are going to be the workouts where the whole group is together. And then things are going to be very different, and ended up, you know, towards March, April, that my 70.3 athletes ended up doing a lot of the stuff that was very different. Like the sessions with intensity were pretty different between groups, and then they ended up like integrating the group by doing like, you know, both groups are going to be doing a 50-minute run or a 1.5-hour easy bike. So that's a good opportunity for them to for everyone to be together.
Yeah. So what does it take to become a member of the squad, really? What is required of the athletes to get in, and what is required of them when they are in? Because it's I can imagine that you do put requirements on the athletes.
it's a pretty organic process. You know, it's very similar to the way other coaches operate. It's basically, you know, like other coaches, like I have a training group, and a lot of times, you know, some athletes are interested in the squad, some other athletes, I'm interested in coaching them because I feel it's going to be a good match. So it's going to be like the way athletes come into the squad. It's very organic, and it's going to depend on the individuals, basically. So it's not like, you know, at the beginning when I started the squad, I had a bigger approach where I would just like do like a call to action, and I tried to get as many people to know that I was looking for athletes. And as the level of the athletes in the squad and also, you know, the quality of the work that we were doing has improved, I moved away from that model of recruitment and more into a individual model of recruitment. And as you do good work with the athletes that you have, then more athletes are interested in the work that you do. So basically, like, all the athletes that I have now are coming in by word of mouth or knowing me or knowing the work that I've done with my athletes. And so that's how the squad is growing right now.
Yeah, you were one of the USFT coaches of the year for last year, 2016, and you had 2 of 3 US Olympians on the men's side. And also, mm-hmm. Summer Cook had her big breakthrough with winning an ITU race in Edmonton. So you done really well with your athletes during last year. So that I can imagine that it's not, that word of mouth is more than enough at this point to get mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. potential athletes. Yes. By the way, talking about that Coach of the Year accolade, how does that feel? And how do you look at 2016 for the squad in general? Are you satisfied with what you achieved?
Yeah, it's always interesting to get an award. I was pretty happy that I got nominated, and the way the process is just like the athletes submit some nomination. I wasn't like the driving force behind that, and I had my athletes just like write some testimonials, and so that's how the process went. Regarding 2016, I think, you know, the Olympics are pretty they're a pretty life-changing experience, and then the next day they're over, and there's also a lot of emptiness, you know. So 2016 was just like a, you know, a big whirlwind, and qualifying the guys at the same time, also pretty sad. I was pretty sad that Eric Lagerstrom was really close to making the team, and he ended up not making the team. So there was kind of like a down point, but then there's a lot of just like huge focus in the Olympics, and then you get there and you do it, and then it's over. I was lucky as a coach to just rebound from the Olympics with seeing a Summer win the WTS Edmonton, which was also like, you know, really, really cool to see. Summer is still a big work in progress, but winning a WTS is always going to be a pretty big landmark. So it was 2016 was just the culmination of, you know, a lot of years of work and grinding and doing a job and all that stuff. So it was good, but you know, it's as soon as it's over, it's just building for the season and new projects and lots of new athletes and just and you know, and last year it's gone, and all this, and what's in front of you is what matters now.
Mm. So what are your goals for the squad now going forward? And if you can look a bit further ahead, let's say to the next Olympic Games or so, and even beyond that, if you have any big grand visions for it.
Yeah, right now it's just the squad is very, very ITU centered. So most of the athletes are ITU athletes. And the first year of the quad is always a year where you, particularly like with new athletes, you try to get a sense of who they are and how to work better with them. And those athletes that I've been working for longer time is just trying to find, without a lot of pressure. Right now we don't have the pressure of having to have points. We're pretty far from Olympic qualification starting and all that stress. So there's a great opportunity right now to just work towards the Olympics in a low pressure situation. And so it's an opportunity to just like test out new methods, test out new ways of doing things. Not push things really hard, because there's going to come a time where we're going to be, both me and the athletes are going to be, you know, way out of our comfort zones in order to, as the pressure builds up for Olympic qualification. So this year's going to be, I wouldn't call it easier year, but a year where making mistakes, or they're not going to have like big repercussions in the future.
Mm. And you mentioned there that the athlete's workload and your workload will be increasing. And I'm curious, what does your work look like on a day-to-day basis, in addition to the on-deck coaching? And what does it consist of?
Yeah, I'm really like hands-on, one-stop shop for everything. So I end up doing like on top of coaching sessions, I end up doing a lot of stuff like, you know, bike fitting, even working bike mechanic, meeting with the athletes. Like when you ask me something about coaching individuals, one thing that I do is the way I interact with the athletes is going to be on an individual basis. So I, through the years, I kind of like moved away from that squad meeting, rah-rah, motivational stuff and more. And basically now I might have like, you know, one or two squad meetings a year and moving towards just having individual meetings with the athletes. So when you have, you know, 12 or 14 athletes at training camp, if you're going to meet with them individual, that's a lot of time that it takes. Then there's always going to be like stuff that needs to be taken care of, or athletes that need to meet with me on a daily basis. So there's, you know, there's always stuff to do, and it's basically nonstop, you know, roughly between 8 a.m. and like 5 p.m., something like that. So there's, you know, there's always stuff. The athletes all live in the same area. It's really easy for them to just come and see me like unannounced at where I live. So it's it's a lot of, it's a full day's work, 7 days a week, basically.
Yeah. How often do you have those individual meetings with athletes, and how long do they last for?
A lot of times I'm going to have athletes that just want to chat about something, and I might have like a 10, 15 minute conversation after a session, before a session, something like that. If I have a round of meetings, which usually happen, you know, if like every month or something like that, then those might last as long as like 20 to 30 minutes. And then there's like punctual meetings where just an athlete just reaches out and says like, hey, do you have a time to chat? And that might take a while. So ends up being like a lot of individual communication as well. And also there's also like, you know, stuff like logistics and plans and race plans and what to do. And so there's always a lot of communication going with the athletes, and also going to be dependent on individuals. Some are more communication oriented. I don't want to use the word high versus low maintenance. I'm going to say communication oriented. Some are more communication oriented. Some are more like task oriented, or they just do what's in front of them. So it's going to depend on each individual.
Mm. Are some athletes also taking a larger part in their own, the makings of their own training program, and having a lot of suggestions for how they want to train? Or is it all up to you and they all follow that structure? Or how does that work?
I like to discuss with athletes basically like big picture questions. So basically and listen to a lot of input on them in terms of big picture. So for example, we might start a block and I just might listen to the like a specific athlete might have some feedback on just like, you know, I like short reps and not long reps, you know, that kind of stuff. Or I like this kind of training method that it's been good for me in the past, you know, and that's the kind of stuff that I listen to and that I integrate in their work. I try to stay away from, you know, from the kind of like, you know, in the moment decision where we're like deciding if we should, you know, run 1 hour and a half or 2 hours or do 10 repeats instead of eight, you know. A bunch of times what I'll do is just like get like general feedback from them. But, you know, 90% of the times the session that I have in mind for them, it's the one that we're going to be executing. So basically try to stay away from like, you know, from a la carte training and more into just like trying to get the big picture right, and then leave the day-to-day decisions to me.
Okay. And one thing that you might have some insight into, that's also another thing that probably my the question that I'm most curious about for you specifically, since you coach elite athletes in a high performance environment. Do you have any, can you tell us anything about what it takes to make it at a top level in terms of physical attributes and mental attributes, and how trainable each of these are? What's more important, and what can you train and what can't you train?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say like the biggest thing is talent, and talent for the sport, and with some experience, a lot of times you can see that talent. I would say that like mental makeup is where the biggest variation happens with athletes. I don't know if it's just an attribute, but I think it's just like human attribute, is that like I coach athletes with very different personalities, and even if there's not going to be a big range in mindset and the way they approach the sport, in terms of like, you know, physical characteristics, they're going to be statistically very similar. But I would say that like talent for the sport and natural ability is going to be a pretty big deciding factor. We like to tell kids, particularly here in the US, that you can accomplish anything that you want to, or that you set your mind to. But obviously when it comes to elite sports, that's not the case, and just that raw talent for the sport is going to be important. Then in terms of like mental approach and mental like just creating your performance mindset and how you approach the sport, obviously it's something that's going to be a blend between your own natural abilities in that department, but also a lot of learning what works for you, and also a little bit of support and guidance from your coach can go a long way there.
Okay. So piggybacking on what you alluded to earlier about your background in fluid dynamics, so I want to just give the listeners a brief background, because we're a bit pressed for time trying to fit everything into. I try to keep these interviews to below 40 minutes or so, but we have a little bit of time. So you're a mechanical engineer by trade, and you have a PhD in computational fluid dynamics. So how uh-huh. did you get into triathlon and coaching?
Actually, it started when I was in engineering school. The triathlon team in my school is one of the oldest triathlon teams in Portugal. So basically, there's been a triathlon team in my school since triathlon started in Portugal in the mid 80s. So there was a long tradition of triathlon in my school. And then when I got interested in the sport, and I can even remember like a friend of mine one day just got to me and said like, I'm going to do a triathlon, which is swim, bike, run. And he tells me like, I just got a bike. And then he started like telling me about the sport. And it was funny that like my friend ended up never doing a triathlon in his life. And this was something, you know, I'm a triathlon lifer now. So I got interested in the sport, and, you know, it's interesting just like, you know, finishing a triathlon and kind of like built from there. And around that time that I was graduating from my undergrad, the team was just pretty in dire straits and nobody was taking care of it. And so I started organizing the team and managing the team and making it grow. And then we got to the point where we're one of the biggest triathlon teams in Portugal. So this was like mid 90s or towards the end of the 90s. And then I started seeing that the coaches were not good enough, and I had to start coaching the athletes. And that's how I started coaching athletes in the team. This was like, you know, a college/age group team. And then basically from then on, I just started like, you know, coaching anyone that would come into the team. And that's how I got into coaching. Mm-hmm. And as I pursued my graduate studies, I also like continued just like coaching. And so that was like the beginning for me to start coaching was just, you know, having a day job and then having coaching being my hobby.
Yeah. And then you got to the United States at what point and in what capacity?
I came to the US in 2005, and this was after I finished my PhD, and I did two postdocs here in the US, and then while I was in the US, it was, you know, it was easier to build a practice of coaching age groupers, and at the same time also started coaching some pros here. I still had some Portuguese athletes that I was still coaching while I was here, and I had at the time I was coaching Sergio Marquez, which at the time he was a pretty decent Ironman athlete. He got two top 20s in Kona in 2005 and 2006, and so basically with you know, Sergio was pretty much like the seed for me to start coaching elites, and so, you know, while I was in the US and doing my postdocs, I kind of like built my practice as a coach to the point that allowed me to just, you know, get to 2010 and get the triathlon scout going.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, one more thing about your background as well. I actually just yesterday talked to your friend Nuno Placeres. So he will be on the show, the episode before yours, I think. So that will be soon. But how do you know him? Is that also from
yeah? Me and Nuno go way back to the time where Nuno was also getting involved in triathlon, and then he started training with us and racing for our team. And actually, Nuno was a pretty big help at the time in getting the team like with a high profile and helping out with getting the team just started. And he was a pretty big force in getting us to have group workouts and team bike ride and stuff like that. So Nuno and I just go way back, and you guessed it, I used to coach Nuno back in the day as well.
Yeah.
And I coached him for triathlon and for a couple of marathons, I think. So me and Nuno, we just go way back.
Yeah, and if somebody happens to listen to this episode and it's their first episode, then what we talked about with Nuno is aerodynamics on the bike largely, and also some other ways to get so-called free speed on your bike. So you can go back an episode and listen to that. All right.
I hope you told Nuno that he needs to buy a new helmet, because I've been telling him that for the last couple of years.
He has a Rudy Project one now.
Oh, no comments.
Okay, so Paolo, I want to go into three rapid-fire questions.
Okay.
So the first one is, what's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
Drinking coffee.
Okay, yeah. I've never considered that, but I do that myself, so hopefully that's something that could be useful. What do you wish you had known or wish you had done differently at some point in your career?
It's a lot on your experiences and learning from your experiences. So basically, you know, this might be a very zen answer, but just what I am now as a coach is the product of all the experience that I had, both good and bad. So basically, like, doing something different is, you know, maybe like what I could have done different, maybe not a lot, maybe sometimes a little bit of luck here and there could have made things better, but they could have also made things worse. So you never know.
Mm. And who are your mentors or some people that you look up to in triathlon?
Definitely two people that I learned from a lot. Two Canadians, or one Canadian and one person without a country now. The first, Joel Filiol. I've been friends with Joel for over 10 years now, and I've learned a lot from him. Not as much from you know, Joel telling me what to do, but basically on the discussions that we've had have helped me tremendously in learning how to coach and being a coach and focusing on the right things. I think that a lot of coaches a lot of times focus on the wrong things, and that prevents them from being better. And the other person would be Simon Whitfield. Just the time that I work with him, and also the time that I've known him, I learned a ton from him. He was just he's an athlete that had like a tremendous like competitive drive. He was someone with tremendously like good instincts when it came to triathlon. I like to say that he has a high triathlon IQ, somebody that's with instincts to sometimes he would say something like, well, I don't think that's a good thing. And he probably couldn't explain it why, but it was just almost always like, you know, right. So these were two people that I feel like I've learned more from. Yeah. And apart from that, just, I'm a pretty big believer on just like learning from your experiences, learning from coaching, learning from working with athletes at whatever level you you learn a ton about training and about coaching by just coaching and working with athletes.
Yeah. Do you have some examples of some of the wrong things that coaches might focus on sometimes, as you mentioned that?
I think there's a lot of focus on what sessions to do, what kind of training to do, what's the right amount of intensity, what's the right amount of volume, and about the planning, just having a plan and following it. While when you work with athletes on a daily basis, we're just trying to create something that's sustainable and that allows the athletes to train consistently and derive performance from that consistency. And the more you're bogged down to the plan, the more you're bogged down to today we need to do this session, or to think about training as just like the key session, the magical sessions that we have to have, or the test session that we need to do in order to progress. I think doing a lot of that is focusing on the wrong things.
Yeah, so if you would draw a Venn diagram, then programming would be a small circle within a much bigger circle that is coaching, basically.
Well, you know, being a mechanical engineer and on the fluid thermodynamic side, we don't deal a lot with Venn diagrams. Those were my courses that I didn't pay attention. I would say that like seeing athletes by being people and listening to them and just tailoring, still being a coach but listening to them and what they're telling you and picking up on the clues to just move the work forward. I think that's the biggest thing.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Paolo. This has been very great. Where can the listeners find out more about you and connect with you? You do have a podcast together with Joel Filial, the Real Coaching Podcast, but it has been a bit inactive recently. Is there any chance that it's coming back soon?
Probably not. We just mainly just joke about it and say that whenever we have something that we wanted to say, we say, oh, maybe we should start a podcast. I think the biggest problem with a podcast is it's just most of the times we're like in different time zones and just with really different schedules. So like finding a time for us to sit down and record a podcast is really, really hard. So I don't see the podcast coming back in the near future. In order to find me, I have a very obnoxious Twitter account that everyone can find me at PS Triathlon, and that's pretty much like the best way to keep track of what I'm doing, because I don't have a website. I moved away from that kind of stuff and just focusing more on the, you know, on the day-to-day coaching and less on website business side of coaching.
Yeah. Okay, thank you again. It has been a pleasure to talk to you.
No worries. Thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
All right, so I really hope that you enjoyed that interview. Thanks again to Nuno Prazeres, who was on the last episode, on episode 25, for putting me in touch with Paolo to help us arrange this interview. On the next episode of That Triathlon Show, we will go back to something very, very practical again. And this will be, as I have mentioned a couple of episodes ago, training zones. Now we're actually going to do that interview and I'm not going to reschedule. So that will be at least a three-part series. So for swimming, cycling, and running separately. So part one will be for swimming. As we usually do in triathlon, we put swimming first. So this episode will cover how to determine training zones and what they are. Most importantly, how you should use them to make your training more effective. So I think that's it for today's episode. I really hope that you enjoyed it, and if you did, remember to subscribe to the podcast in your podcast player app or in iTunes. And as always, I would really, really appreciate if you could tell your triathlon friends about the show to help me spread the word. You'll find the show notes for today's episode on thattriathlonshow.com. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart, and keep loving triathlon.